Adam Lapp.
The best part of waking up, it's the doo-wop, doo-wop in all I do. The mountain goat aroma, always coming through.
Always coming through.
Oh, the best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup. Now I'm right in harmony with that doo-wop, doo-wop ditty. Whoa, one more cup and it's a hoo-wop, shabop for me. Oh, the best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup. The best part of waking up is Folgers in your cup.
So unless you've been living in a cave somewhere, because actually I think Fred Flintstone and Barney Rubble listen to the show, so notwithstanding my favorite cartoon characters, unless you've been living in a cave or under a rock, you're aware that later today is the big event. I guess they call it the SOTU, or the State of the Union, voiced, and I would imagine at least 10% written by our beloved President Donald, Mr. DJ Trump himself. To discuss this upcoming event and other things going on today, yesterday, and in the future, we bring along our resident presidential scholar, political guru, and all-around interesting, historically inclined person down in Florida, where it's not just spring-like part of the year, but spring-like or summer-like 12 months out of the year. Boca Raton, Florida, to be specific. Dr. Ronald Fineman, good morning, Ron. Thank you again for being on the show with me today.
Good morning, Adam. Again, it's a pleasure to be on your show.
Always an enjoyable experience. And again, the obligatory wisecrack, I don't take myself too seriously. There's no reason to do that. As I mentioned earlier, Ron, this is the big day. It is the SOTU, I guess they call it, that's how you pronounce it, State of the Union. Will you be viewing today's State of the Union address?
Yes, tonight I will be viewing it and watching to see his reaction, if you know, to the members of Congress wearing black, and possibly if somebody speaks up and says, like the South Carolina congressman who responded to Obama's State of the Union by saying, "You lie," and to see whether that happens and how the president reacts to it.
I understand that one of your fellow Floridians, Congressperson Federica Wilson, she will not be attending in a protest of sorts. Otherwise, we could be discussing what she might be wearing in terms of her hat and her clothing, because that's part of the interesting nature of Congressperson Wilson. You're not quite sure what she'll be donning, but it'll certainly be something different than the usual jeans and a T-shirt or the pantsuits that are favored by, of course, Mrs. Clinton. But she won't be attending. Do you think other congresspeople will be protesting either on site by wearing black or carrying a sign or whatever, or just not attending at all?
Well, I know that my, you know, my congressman locally, Louis Franco, is going to be wearing black, and also Debbie Wasserman Schultz, but they're going to attend. And I think there's a number of others around the country of other members of the House that are going to do so. I don't think any senators are going to do that. But it'll be interesting to see the, you know, the reaction of the crowd, of the audience, I should say, to Trump and him to them, if they do not all applaud him, because he wants total, love, and he's not going to get it from the Democratic side. And possibly not from a small number of Republicans.
Now, like or dislike aside, Ron, is that disrespectful to the president to wear black, which is associated more with a tragic event or a funeral or et cetera? Has that ever happened before? Has there been a protest so obvious where Donald Trump will look out and see people wearing a color not associated with something that should be more of a happy event?
Yeah, I am not aware that this has ever happened before. It might have, but it does not stick out of my memory, certainly not any time recently. So I have a feeling it may be a first-time event. And is it appropriate? I don't know. I guess it depends how you look at it. But after all, there is such a thing as freedom of speech, and that includes how you dress for an event like that. So while I might not necessarily, I would not do it myself if I was in Congress, I can't deny someone the right to their own expression of how they dress.
So you'd kind of be with me that freedom of expression is important, although as a public servant, a politician paid by taxpayers like you and me, some respect is in order. But if you have such an issue with the current administration, maybe you need to kind of stand out and explain why. And so it's a very touchy issue, like almost anything is when it comes to politics.
Yes, it is. There's no question about it.
But I guess we'll wait and see. One thing about this administration is there will always be a surprise. In fact, while we're doing this show, more than likely There will be happenings at the White House, but I don't really want to rewind. That's part of the fun of live radio. As you're talking, sometimes you have to stop the presses, or in this case, stop the microphone because of a different occurrence. Also, looking at one of your Florida Congress people, Ron, the gentleman known affectionately as Little Marco, I guess he fired one of his staff members for some indiscretions. Is that making a lot of, it's making a lot of news here in Ohio. Is that making a lot of headlines in your neck of the woods?
Yes, in the local newspapers it is, because Marco Rubio, of course, is a person who ran for president, and I think he's thinking about how things look as far as, you know, if he has a future plan to run, and I think what he did probably is correct, but it is quite a shocking action to remove your chief of staff. That's the top person in your office. And I know at least one person who has been a chief of staff. It's a very responsible job, and for the senator or House member to remove him or her is quite a extreme action, but I think it's the right thing to do under the circumstances that I gather that he used as a reason to do so.
So indiscretions are not tolerated, and maybe ironically we've seen some of that type of behavior from Mr. Trump and some of his cohorts. But I think Marco Rubio did do the right thing. It's a, as I say, slippery slope. I know I said that word multiple times last week, but it is. And you're not quite sure what to do. Rubio is in his 40s. Certainly his career as a nationally known politician is beginning. And maybe not next election, but maybe 10 or 20 years down the road, he'll have some more very serious aspirations for president. And showing that he does the right thing.
I don't think it's 10 to 20 years down the road. I think it's 2020 or 2025. He plans to be thinking about this 10 to 20 years from now. I think he has short-term plans.
I guess I was thinking with ages, Ron, he's 46 or so versus one of our favorite perennial presidential contenders who might very well be running next election, Joe Biden, who's pushing 80. We have to take a look at
78 he would be in 2020, yes.
Right, would be the ages of these politicians. And certainly that could be used as an argument for and against somebody. Again, everybody ages differently, and as you and I have talked about briefly, you are older than you would come across, both in appearance and just your general attitude. And that applies to many people, and some people actually seem older. I would say Rubio does seem like he is his actual age, and although certainly you and I are not overly thrilled with a lot of his policies, I think he does have good ambitions, and may need to work on a few professionalism aspects. But he's a decent speaker. He's got a nice family, so down the road he could be again a very serious contender. And not only do we take a look at how he acted rather swiftly, and I think professionally in this indiscretion with his high level staff member, but also how he weathered the storm against the name calling by the current president, being called Little Marco. Yes, he is little. That's fine. That's what he looks like. But I think it is kind of rude to say that during a debate or some kind of a press conference.
Well, but Donald Trump is famous for being rude, so there's nothing new about that. He's rude against everybody.
Yeah. Right. He's not known as
the
most
manly.
But that's what people like about him. He does come across as that regular guy. But as we've discussed, I like people that are regular guys also. And, you know, Obama certainly was in that category, and Carter also, and many politicians of all levels. But there is a time and a place for certain types of behavior, certain language. And we discussed the PG-13 rated language of Donald Trump also, and I don't want to beat that around like a dead horse. But certainly there are a time and place for stuff. And being a gentleman, being a lady is part of the office, and there are politicians that certainly could use some work on that. Let me ask you this, Ron, before I get to another topic. Has your respect or opinion of Rubio improved because of the way that he handled this firing, or are you still kind of down on the guy?
Well, I don't see him as someone I would support for president, but I do think what he did was a smart move, and it does improve his image, and I think it was the right thing to do. But I am not impressed by his intellect, honestly. I don't think he's that bright, and I don't think he's that qualified, even though he's been a senator. And I don't see him really ever being the nominee of the Republican Party, but he certainly can compete for it, and he will be part of the race in the future, 2020, 2024, and beyond.
So the way he handled this somewhat difficult staff issue, you do like, and I agree, but he needs to prove a lot more before you would consider him to be a viable presidential candidate. I would say we probably agree on that. Yeah, we probably agree. And again, he is one of your two senators, so love him or hate him, he's part of the scene. and we have to take a
look at... Bill Nelson is far better, and Bill Nelson's facing a tough race against Governor Rick Scott. I hope he keeps that seat, because I want, you know, the Democratic Party to have at least this Florida seat to be kept, but it's one of the big races in the midterm election. But Bill Nelson, I think, has done a very good job.
We are speaking with Dr. Ronald Fineman, yes, a gentleman of much knowledge of presidents, current and last 100 years or so of U.S. history, and of course,
and
always
the Senate.
Interesting opinion, or two, a published author. He's written two popular books, a blogger, part-time professor, and who knows whatever else he might be into, and we'll probably discuss that sometime during this show. Ron, if we were to do a show again tomorrow after the SOTU has taken place, there's obviously going to be a surprise or two. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Anything with President Trump is likely to turn a few heads and probably startle a few millions of people. What do you think might be, if you can forecast this at all, what do you think might be one or two of the surprises that we'll witness this evening as we listen to the State of the Union?
I hope I'm wrong, but I expect he's going to insult the Democratic Party and probably say something he should not say or propose something that he knows would not be acceptable. I just have a feeling, but it's hard to project ahead of time. But I don't think he knows how to behave, and I don't think he will come across as just a normal, sedate speaker for the State of the Union. I'm sure there's going to be something that's going to be highly controversial coming out of what happens tonight. But I can't really project what. He's hard to figure out. He's hard to, to try to plan ahead for.
And that's part of the charm. You like that off-the-cuff approach, but again, he does need to work on being a gentleman and probably improving some language skills. But we'll just have to wait and see. Now, as someone in live broadcasting, Ron, we're talking live on the air, and what we say goes out, whether it's likable, not likable, or even something that you're allowed to say by the FCC. Now, we talked last week about whether the Donald will be using the four-letter word beginning with S, like he seems to... Well, he claimed he didn't say it, but I think he did. But you would agree, Ron, as I would, that he is going to, more than likely, including some coaching by the people that are in charge of coaching and coordinating the speech, that he will not be using any words that you wouldn't say in front of your grandma, so to speak. He will at least try to, he may not use the best English, but he will tone down his language. Or might we be surprised? Might an S or an F word suddenly come out of his mouth? What are the chances of that happening?
Well, is one of his key writers of his speeches is Stephen Miller, who's born Jewish, but as people call him, he's a Nazi, and he's very anti-immigrant, and he's an outrage. And I think he may have an effect where it may show up as a Stephen Miller speech more than anything else, and that worries me, because Stephen Miller is a menace, I think. And I think, you know, I really advocate he should be kicked out of the administration, but he has a great effect at only age 32, and I've never seen anybody that young have such an impact on a president as he does. So I am concerned, but, you know, that's tonight, and we don't know what's going to come about. We'll see whether, you know, whether this fear I have works out to be reality.
So you actually would not be completely surprised if one of those words you're not supposed to say on television comes out of Donald's mouth. Would that be a good way to say it?
I don't know about the word itself, but I think the implication, the nativist implication, is going to be there. But I'm not sure he would actually use the S word or something like that. Hopefully not. But I think it'll be pretty clear that I think that he's promoting an anti-immigrant hysteria in this country. Even though there are a few immigrants that have committed crimes who are illegal immigrants, it is not as if it's a mass wave of people doing it. And I just think it's wrong the way he's approached the whole issue of immigration. But that is the whole idea of Stephen Miller since he was in high school in California and against his own family's tradition. So I just have a feeling, you know, Stephen Miller has a great impact on him and that it will affect the speech tonight.
So you're expecting immigration to be one of the major topics of the speech?
Well, it's actually been stated it will be. So, and the question is how he approaches it and what he has to say. But yes, I do think it is going to be because he is planning an increase in deportation. It's clear, and that I think is horrendous because we're talking about people who have done nothing wrong other than how they came here. And of course, this includes the DACA kids. I don't think the DACA kids are going to be protected at the end. I think there'll never be an agreement on it because he's setting up impossible standards of what he expects on immigration. So I think there's going to be, there's going to be inability to accomplish the goal by March 5th. It's only a month away, a little more than a month away. And I feel bad for those kids. And some of them are at the colleges I teach at. So the expectation is enrollments are going to go down dramatically in the next year and probably all around the country because a lot of these kids do go to college and some of them are in the military and yet they have no protection after March 5th.
So we're getting into the second topic of today, at least topics we planned on talking about. It's always a surprise, and I go off on a tangent, but that's part of the fun. We kind of stimulate a brain cell or two with something we brought up and try to go a little further on that. Obviously, DACA is being fought as we speak, yesterday, tomorrow, and for the foreseeable future. And apparently it's split. I think the last thing I saw was 48% of Democrats and Republicans feel there should be a path to citizenship of some kind for the, we call them dreamers. But that's split down the middle, and obviously it's a sensitive topic, a divisive one, and sometimes it isn't even overly partisan. There's Democrats who feel like a Republican might be expected to, and vice versa. Will they come to a resolution, Ron? You're kind of looking at it as if they won't. A year from now, for example, the students that you teach there in college, will they feel a little more comfortable about becoming citizens or not being deported? What do you think will come of this, or is it still something we have to throw our hands up at this point?
It's something that we still have to throw our hands up, but I am not optimistic. And the point is, in many public opinion polls, 85 to 90% say they should be allowed to remain, even if not citizenship, but it may be eventual pathway to citizenship. But a vast majority say that, as do a vast majority of one gun regulation. But the Republican Party is not willing to follow through on either one of these, even though public opinion is very high, based on polls.
But obviously, it's a divisive, sensitive issue. And even experts like yourself, we're not quite sure. We don't want to go ahead and commit to something, put the cart before the horse, because the minute we think something's going to happen, it'll be the opposite.
Well, I'm not optimistic because he's been playing games with this issue for the last 6 months, our president, and I don't think he really wants to resolve the issue. He just says he does. And again, Stephen Miller has a bad effect on him. So does John Kelly, the White House chief of staff. They're both strong nativists. And I do think that their goal is to hopefully, in their mind, deport a lot of these kids, plus many others, like that man who was here 30 years and is deported from Detroit that was recently reported, and the woman, I forget where it was, maybe in Texas, who was forced out away from her family. And I just think this is horrendous, what ICE is doing.
So the students that you teach, Ron, who are dreamers, are they really worried? Do they kind of every day waking up thinking, is this the last day I can attend the fabulous Dr. Feynman's class because I might have to go back to my native country? Or are they just kind of taking it day by day?
Well, the truth is, I've only started the classes a couple of weeks, so we haven't gotten into that kind of thing in great detail. It'll probably be discussed more in passing later on. But right now, I'm still getting to know the students, but I know some of them are people under DACA, I do know, and the enrollment at the college has dropped quite a bit this term. I'm not sure if it's just the spring term that it's less than the fall, or partly it is because people are not signing up for college or afraid to go. I'm not sure exactly, but the college is worried about the effects of if DACA is not continued, that it will affect enrollment and the future of the college.
So it's affecting things like college enrollment. And how much?
Well, not just here, but across the country. I'm sure it's true in California, in Texas, particularly in Arizona, states with heavy Hispanic populations, along with Florida. Yes.
So the
probably more so than Florida. Florida has more Cubans, but the other states have more Mexicans and Central American refugees. Yes.
So the DACA recipients that you are teaching, they are Latino.
Mostly, and yes, but some of them also Cubans, and Cubans are protected. I'm talking about those who are not Cubans.
Okay.
Yes.
So I guess it's a wait and see, and at least you know you're doing the best you can teaching these folks, hopefully educating them, arming them with information, but never quite sure what's going to happen. And
no, it's very unsettled, but I guess that's what the president likes, to create instability and chaos and anarchy, even within the White House staff. After a year, we've had such a turnover, it's unheard of, the amount of turnover in just 1 year.
In your blog, Ron, theprogressiveprofessor.com, you have some lighter topics, some more serious topics, and again, a lot of forecasting. One of the more interesting ones that my eyes viewed would have been from the 26th, which was the 50 states and educational levels, with the conclusion being that Democrats are, in general, more educated than Republicans. Top 10 states are in New England and the Middle Atlantic states. Not really surprisingly, because that's where the Ivy League and very competitive colleges are. Not that there aren't great colleges in other places. Duke, for example, in North Carolina, and many, many great colleges even here in Ohio. But Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, and UVM, Yale, Harvard, New Hampshire, Dartmouth, I believe it's in New Hampshire, Maryland, New Jersey, Virginia, Johns Hopkins, and many other great colleges. Rutgers, where my dad went, so even some family connotations there. Virginia, greatly influenced by the educational level of the northern Virginia suburbs outside of D.C. Also in Midwest, not Ohio, but Minnesota, Colorado, and the Rocky Mountain West, and the state of Washington, probably influenced by all the software companies in the Seattle area. But we take a look at California, and need I say Florida, and Texas rank lower on educational attainment because of large numbers of immigrants with lower accomplishments due to language barriers, but are rated higher in quality of education ranking. New York, Illinois, Delaware, Oregon, and Hawaii are among the states which are ranked in the second 10 best states. And I went to college in upstate New York, and there are many great schools there, but it's a large, diverse state, and the North Country area, the area north of Syracuse and Albany, where I went to school, outside of the education, is rather poor. And it's almost like an oasis when you're in a town like the one I went to and go to college there. In the lower end, we visit a neighboring state, two neighboring states, Kentucky and West Virginia, and a somewhat of a neighbor state, Tennessee. Those were among the 10 lowest, Nevada, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. No offense, Mr. and Mrs. Clinton. So top 10 lowest states, again, mostly in the South. Again, there are exceptions. You know, I might joke about it. You know, Bill Clinton, we've talked about like the most intelligent presidents. Love him or hate him, he is considered one of the most intelligent and most educated, and I would agree with that. Hillary's not really from Arkansas, as we talked about a couple of shows ago, but she has connections there.
Illinois, which she grew up Chicago. Yeah.
Being the first lady and married to the governor, and Bill Clinton is a native of the area. So there certainly are exceptions. But is this a problem, Ron? Bottom line is people in New England are most educated. People in the South are least educated. And, you know, as I say, I like the ironies, two of our most intelligent recent presidents, Carter and Clinton, the ones considered two of the highest IQs, they're both from the Deep South.
Because everything is generalization, obviously.
Right.
There's good students in the South. There's good universities in the South. But overall, the educational level is a lot lower in the South. They're much poorer states economically, and they get a lot of funding from, you know, indeed from blue state taxation. And yet there's this rivalry between the blue and red states.
But is this an issue where we need to have more consistent education in the Deep South? It seems like West Virginia, a state very close to Ohio, a beautiful state with a low cost of living, and which has some good colleges. Marshall in Huntington is a good college. For example, again, it's not New Jersey or New York or Massachusetts or Ohio, but there's plenty of educational opportunities there. Now, it is suffering from less coal industry. And again, some of the Appalachian economy problems that we've seen, which we even have here in Ohio. But do we need to work on more of a parity and equality so that West Virginia, Arkansas, Kentucky, another neighboring state, are not always down on the list? And maybe we need to find some intervention of some kind to increase the educational level in those states.
Yeah, but they don't want federal intervention. They're against federal government standards on education. They want to run their own states. They've always been states' rights oriented, and they resent any federal intrusion. And that's a big problem, because that's why they remain backward, because they refuse federal assistance or they look down on it. And it's a real headache for the future, because the South has always been the poorest section of the country in general, and it continues to be.
So, Ron, do these states need to swallow their pride and accept some government help so that they're not constantly at the bottom of the list? I'm just not comfortable being an Ohioan, as much as I love Kentucky and West Virginia, that they always seem to be at the bottom of this list. And it's like I almost feel jealous. Ohio, it's not as high up as New Jersey or Massachusetts, but it's up there. And I live in an area with many great colleges. And
yes.
I almost feel guilty about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they should, but there's no way that, you know, the state governments are very anti federal government, they're anti-government, basically. And you see that every time a Republican gets elected, you know, to like Kentucky. Kentucky had a Democratic governor, Steve Beshear, and he covered under Obamacare. Now it's gone, and Kentucky's much poorer under Matt Bevin. And this recent gun shooting that occurred in Kentucky, what's his answer? Thoughts and prayers. That drives me crazy. Everybody says thoughts and prayers. That's why I wrote about gun regulation. Everybody says thoughts and prayers, but in Great Britain, there was a massacre 20 years ago, and they passed gun regulations and took away guns from private owners. And in Australia, the same thing. And both countries have very low gun violence because they regulate guns, and they take away from people's guns because we have too many in this country. And this country, it's like now when, when a massacre occurs, like in that Kentucky high school, it's not even talked about as a front page story anymore. It's like, oh well, and move on. And this has been the way it's been since the incident in Connecticut, the elementary school in 2012. There's just no reaction, and the president doesn't even say anything about it. President Obama always had a press conference and was upset about it and talked about it. He doesn't even talk about it on Twitter, our president.
So you think it might be a good idea if these states would accept some government help, but you see them as...
And also on gun regulation, but he will not do that. Right. The government's ignoring these issues about education and about gun violence. And it's happening in a lot of these rural southern states, often more than it does elsewhere.
So it's not an easy solution in that it's logical for me as a person from a state neighboring Kentucky and West Virginia to be upset about this, if not feel a little bit guilty that Ohio is a fairly well-educated state. But the solution isn't going to happen overnight as much as we'd like to think it will. But hopefully at some time it will.
I wouldn't bet on it, though, because of the mentality of the governments of these states and the general dislike of the federal government by many of the people of these states. They seem to want to wallow in ignorance, it seems, and it's really terrible. It's bad for the nation's future and for the state's future.
You're mentioning that the higher educated states tend to be blue or more Democrat, lower educated states as red. Who's more on the liberal side, definitely a Democrat, Ron. What do you think about that? Do you really think Democrats are smarter, more well educated, or is there something a little deeper than that?
I don't think it's just an issue of Democrats are smarter, Republicans. I think both are smarter, and they also have those who are not. I think it's the whole attitude about what the role of government is. That's the debate between Democrats and Republicans. Democrats trust the national government and believe in more federal regulation, and Republicans do not. And that's, I think, the real crux of the debate that goes on in our country. Always has been, actually, since the time of Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. It's still going on. The Democrats are the Hamiltonian Party, and the Republicans are the Jeffersonian Party. And it's never going to end, and the South remains backward. Certain states are doing better. Virginia's doing better. North Carolina, until recently, when it went under the Republicans, was way ahead, but they've fallen behind. Texas, at times, does all right. Florida at times, but much of the South is extremely poor and going nowhere, and population growth is hardly occurring in many of those southern states. So it's a bad omen for the future.
But there are oases, interestingly. Nashville has a well-educated city. Vanderbilt University, I consider going there. One of the top schools anywhere.
Nashville's great. It's a great city, too. I've been there a couple of times. It's a wonderful city.
There's no question rural Tennessee is very different from Nashville, not unlike the way that New York City is not the same as a lot of upstate New York, except for the oases, sometimes smaller cities that have some very good colleges. So New York is interesting study in that regard. And of course, most states are. Ohio also. We have Athens, a small town in rural southeastern Ohio with the great school, Ohio University. But a lot of the surrounding
areas. And it's a great location.
It's very different.
Just like Athens, Greece.
Right. So education is like that. You have a college town surrounded sometimes by an area that has a very different type of demographic and educational level. And maybe some more parity is a good idea, but it just can't happen overnight.
Yeah, that's the case in Florida, where Gainesville, of course, is where the University of Florida is, which is the flagship state university. But around it is pretty rural and small town folk who don't like people coming off the campus into their areas. You know, people who are not white. You know, people. There's a lot of tension nearby, and you know, so this happens all over the country in the rural areas where universities.
I always say it's better if we can just get along, but. Unfortunately, that might be a little too optimistic, but we'll see what can happen. In your blog, Ron, from yesterday, title was Don McGahn. I guess that's how you pronounce it. Kind of a nice name. It rhymes. White House counselor, yes. The new deep throat, or John Dean, as in the Watergate scandal. Now, Ron, you know how much I like talking about, we call him affectionately Tricky Dicky. So anything that is Watergate related or analogous to Watergate will certainly make my eyes pop just a tad. Tell us more about what that blog was about. Again, we just published it yesterday.
Okay. A deep throat is the name that was given by Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein to the secret source that gave them information that brought the downfall of Richard Nixon. And from 1972 on, it was known, you know, that name was used, and it was based on a porn film of 1971, considered the greatest porn film until that time, that both of them had seen. They were in their late 20s when they separately, I guess, saw the film. And for 33 years until 2005, we never knew who the actual source was until, indeed, in that year, a former acting head of the FBI, Mark Felt, who was in his 90s already and starting to lose his mind, you know, starting to have Alzheimer's, came out finally, and they knew it was him, and he held a press conference and all that with his daughter nearby, and indeed told us that he had been the person to give the information that helped to bring Nixon down. But for 33 years, we didn't know, and I remember teaching, especially in early morning classes, about American history and getting to the point of the Nixon administration, and you could see the students were half awake, they weren't quite alert, and all I'd have to do is mention deep throat, the term, and everybody woke up. It was hysterical to see the reaction of students. And, of course, I told them what deep throat was all about. So the question is Don McGahn, or McGahn, I think it's McGahn, the deep throat? Some people think so, but others would say not really, because we're not waiting 33 years or even a year or two. I think it's more like John Dean, the White House counselor, lawyer to the president under Nixon, who went and testified before the Watergate Committee and exposed what was going on in the Nixon administration. So I think rather than being, deal like Mark Felt, I think he's more like John Dean. And John Dean is still around. He's like 78 now, and he's often on different radio stations and also on different TV cable channels, commenting on events and comparing it now to then. So I think he is more like a John Dean, and I think this is a step forward toward the removal of Donald Trump, I should say, at some point soon.
So he's a bit of a whistleblower. Would that be a good term, or is it a little bit
whistleblower?
Different?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But he's still in the White House staff, which is interesting. But apparently, he has spoken to Robert Mueller, and it's just very interesting. He has people on the staff who have all talked to Robert Mueller, and apparently have not been indicted, so it sounds like they're giving information that's going to make the case against the president greater. It's just strange to me how they're still on the White House staff or just recently left. It's a strange story we still do not know the full extent of, because we have not had enough coming out from Mueller at this point.
So just like anything else we talk about, it might change tomorrow, and every day we pick up the news. We wake up, make the coffee, etc. Of course, turn on WWGH, yes. But there is always something new going on at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and even seasoned
never
historians like yourself often aren't even are surprised, because you really just never know. And anything with a whistleblower is going to be interesting, and so I say it's a good time to be in the media business. Never a dull moment, put it mildly. Ron, we touched last week on a kind of an interesting historical topic, one that actually was, I would say, more predominant than I knew. And that topic, of course, was people who have switched, or at least high-level politicians who have switched political parties. And most people are aware that Reagan and Trump used to be Democrats, and they switched to Republican. But there were people, and you sent me a list, Ron, of a couple dozen politicians, past and present, and recent past, who switched their parties. And some I knew about, but some were very surprising. And I would say the one that I was surprised about most was Jesse Helms. Jesse Helms, thought of as being one of the most conservative senators in my lifetime, at least from my knowledge, known as someone who, put it mildly, very much disliked people that weren't heterosexual, certainly wasn't in favor of the people-type issues. I would think in many ways he would make Mike Pence almost seemed like a Democrat. I'm not sure if you would agree with that, but he certainly was known as one of the most socially yes. conservative people ever. But blah, 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 blah aside, he used to be a Democrat. And when I saw that, I said, okay, well, Ron knows, so he wouldn't put him on the list if that was mistaken. But that is awfully surprising, Ron. And would you agree that Jesse Helms might be one of the most surprising people on that list of who has switched from Democrat to Republican?
Yes and no, because you got to realize a lot of Southern Democrats who were segregationists switched after the Civil Rights Act of 1964 under Lyndon Johnson. So he was one of those who switched because the Republican Party took on the Southern Democrats. They're much more, you know, indeed Republican in the South now than Democrats, and they have as great an impact on the Republican Party now as back before Johnson the Southern Democrats had in the Democratic Party. And you got to realize Strom Thurmond, who ran as a states' rights nominee for president in 1948, the so-called Dixiecrats, was a Democrat, and he stayed a Democrat until the 64 Civil Rights Act, and then he became the first well-known Republican already in the Senate to switch over, and an awful lot of the Southern Democrats did switch over, and Jesse Helms, who was a talk show host at the time, was one of the first to do so, but really not all that surprising, because most Southern Democrats in the 60s would not accept the Civil Rights Act, and they resisted it by becoming Republicans and switching the South over the next generation from Democrat to Republican. And that's still the case today. Most Southern members of Congress today are a Republican, with the exception of really the two senators from Virginia and the one Senator Nelson from Florida. That's the and now the senator from Alabama, of course, Doug Jones. They're the only Southern Democrats. You know, and of course, not like the old Democrats, but they're the only Democrats in the South. And as far as House members, most of the Democrats in the House in the South are either Jewish or they are African American or Latino or, in a few cases, women. They are not white Anglos. You don't find, I don't know, in fact, I think there may be one, but basically, that's what's become the Republican Party. It's heavily Southern now as far as the Republican delegations and only those exceptions I've mentioned.
So seeing someone like Jesse Helms might surprise maybe someone of my generation. Again, we're about a generation apart, but you're providing a great explanation that, yes, you would think Democrats were not as extreme social conservative like Helms and some other people with similar beliefs. But with the Civil Rights Act and just some of the general principles of Southern politicians, it isn't surprising. And almost it was a case where his economics were more Democratic, but he switched to Republican because of his people type beliefs. But Jesse Helms maybe surprises me because he's just so well known. I saw him in so many headlines, but he by no means was the only one.
Well, may I mention, though, notice on the list, Elizabeth Warren years ago was a Republican, and she became a Democrat. I think that's stunning to many people. Right. And also Condoleezza Rice went from Democrat to Republican over the years, as another example. And Rudy Giuliani was a Democrat who became a Republican. And, of course, the famous one that went back and forth, is Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. He was a Democrat, became a Republican for a long time, and then ended up as a Democrat in the last years he was in the U.S. Senate. So I think that's fascinating. And John Connolly, who, of course, was with President Kennedy when he was shot, at, you know, in Dallas, was a Democratic governor but became a Republican and was Secretary of the Treasury to Richard Nixon and then tried for the presidency as a Republican in 1980. And Phil Graham, Senator from Texas, was a Democrat who became a Republican. There's an awful long list, you know, when you really look at it, as right. I sent you, of people who more often going to the Republicans from the Democrats, but a few cases the other direction.
Right. So some people just are more in the spotlight, like Helms. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he is the one that's most surprising. It's almost whom you can.
Yeah, how about Rick Perry?
Right.
Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, now Secretary of Energy, was a Democrat. He became the Republican governor of Texas, yes.
Right, and like any show with the professor, time goes by fast. Seems like we've been talking for 10 minutes, but actually we're close to closing time. So just as a note, Ron, that list is interesting, and if anybody would like to see it, please send me an email, adam@wwgh1071.com. I'll be happy to share that list. Again, there are people that we knew about, Reagan and Trump, probably the top of that list. But those who were surprising, we think of the rather liberal Elizabeth Warren, she was a Republican. That certainly is surprising. Giuliani, not too surprising. He's a rather liberal Republican. I mean, he may have changed a bit with the Trump campaign, but when he was mayor of New York City, he was middle of the road, if not a little bit to the left, despite being a Republican. But Warren, does that surprise you as much as it does myself, Ron? Or is there some underlying effect of that?
Well, the thing is, she was that back in the 80s and 90s. And I guess she would say she saw the light. She probably would say. She changed over the years as she was a professor at Harvard, you know, and her attitudes changed and she saw what the Republicans stood for. You know, just like Hillary Clinton was a Goldwater girl as a teenager, and then she became a Democrat. So, I mean, people do change their mind and they get new ideas as they see what's going on around them. But much more it is Democrats become Republicans than Republicans become Democrats, as far as the percentages.
Yeah, if I were to... I guess, and this is only of politicians in my lifetime, the most surprising Democrat to Republican, I would stick with Jesse Helms. Again, I'm talking about within my lifetime as a registered voter.
Yeah.
And I would say the most surprising from Republican to Democrat would be Warren. Warren being more liberal than Clinton, and she just seems like someone who was a liberal the day she came out of the womb. And the fact that she...
But she wasn't.
Right, that she wasn't... the surprise just makes it a little more interesting. Ron, and you,
we all live and learn, as they say.
Since you've been a registered voter, we won't tell people what year you became a registered voter, but since that time, who would you list as the most surprising D to R and R to D switchers?
Probably Warren, I would say. Surprising? That's an interesting question. I don't know. I guess the fact when I found out that Herbert Hoover, in the past, had been a Democrat working for Wilson and then became a Republican. When I first learned that, I guess that surprised me, but that's not in my lifetime. That's before. Otherwise, I would say, well, there's the case of, if I'm looking at the list, I would say, I guess David Duke becoming going from Democrat to Republican. I didn't even realize he was ever a Democrat, but David Duke, the Ku Klux Klan leader, was, but I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But also Howard Dean, who was a candidate in 04, started off as a Republican, Governor Howard Dean, and he went to the Democrats. I think that surprises me quite a bit when I look back at it now, too.
So the two Ds, Dean and Dukes, you would say most surprising as... D to R. We agree on Elizabeth Warren. So you don't agree with me on Jesse Helms, but you do agree he is a bit surprising.
Well, he's surprising, but I think once Strom Thurmond did, I wasn't surprised that other Southerners went to the Republican Party. He like set the standard, Strom Thurmond. So I think he was a little later in it, but I think he's in the same vein as Strom Thurmond. Both, I think, despicable people personally in their views. So I wasn't surprised in that sense, but of course I'm older than you are a bit, so that may be why I had that understanding.
Well, an interesting perspective. Again, a somewhat lighter topic. It seems like most of the topics we talk about are serious and affect the state of the world, but looking at party switching certainly is good food for thought. Again, as an independent, it's a case where I can kind of switch back and forth, and oftentimes I do, but I do go issue by issue. And the idea of being aligned with a certain set of beliefs is
okay.
American.
May I just interject that Howard Dean, being a serious candidate for a while in 04, Hillary in 8 and 16, Warren in the future, these are significant Democrats that all started as Republicans. I think that's an interesting statement.
Right. So among people that are looking to inhabit the Oval Office, those would be some dames to watch for. We may talk about this in the future. It's an interesting topic.
Yes.
And maybe a little more about Elizabeth Warren, because she just seems to me to be someone, I said, who was a Democrat the minute she came out of the womb. But if that's what I think, then I would be mistaken. And by no means do I claim to know everything. Well, Dr. Ronald Fineman, thank you again for being on the Talking Place, WWGH Radio, for a show that we usually call a finer mid-morning coffee break with Adam and the Professor. Good luck in your...
Thank you, Adam. It has been a pleasure.
Yes, in your professorial adventures this winter. And we'll talk soon. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Dr. Ronald Fineman, always a gentleman with interesting opinions, a wealth of knowledge, and a surprise or two, peppered with the occasional and mainly obligatory wisecracks out of the mouth of yours truly. But all kidding aside, we do encourage you to watch and delineate, analyze, critique, etc. The State of the Union address coming up this evening, Love to hear what you think about the address. Any surprises? Again, Dr. Feynman and I discussed what we think may happen, but more than likely, other events will occur during the speech. And I guess that's part of the fun of following politics. And no matter what side of the fence you're on, you can definitely learn something. And as I say, stimulate a brain cell or two, or probably a few million. Adam at WWGH1071.com. That's my email address. Love to hear from you. We'll have another episode of the Adam the Computer Guy radio show this Thursday between approximately 9:13 a.m. and 10. That'll be the first day of February. New month, new show. Great stuff always here on The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. I'd like to remind you that coming up next, it is Linda Sims. And then, after the noon features, Scott Spears, the interviewer to the stars, with the Now program. Also, new show that I produce and co-host. It's on Friday between about 11:13 a.m. and noon. It's called The Protector Show with security expert Ed Johnston. Learn how to be safe and secure in your home, office, car, etc. Interesting information. I've learned quite a bit from my involvement with the show, and I do encourage you to listen. Again, any questions that you have about things that Ed and I have discussed, suggested topics, different viewpoints, always welcome. Adam at WWGH1071.com. Also, be sure to listen to Heaven Express with Paul and Glenna Savage every Sunday afternoon. Excellent show, and they've been with the station for a long time. And if you miss an episode of an Adam the Computer Guy radio show, Now with Scott Spears, the Charlie Evers Show, or, of course, Heaven Express, be sure to go to our website at WWGH1071.com. Click on the show archives, and you can listen on demand at your convenience. Thanks again for tuning us in today. The Talking Place, WWGH Radio.